This is 15 Minute History, a podcast for educators, students, and history buffs featuring the minds and talents of the University of Texas at Austin. 15 Minute History is a partnership of Not Even Past and Hemispheres in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. Welcome back. I'm your host, Christopher Rose, with the Center for Middle Eastern Studies. My guest in the studio is James Joshua Hudson, who is a doctoral candidate in the Department of History, where he's finishing up his dissertation and specializes in the history of modern China. Welcome to the studio.
Thanks, Chris.
So today's topic, we're going to be talking about Hunan province in China. So what specifically are we going to be looking at?
Well, there was a rice riot that occurred in April of 1910 in the capital city of Hunan, which is Changsha. And Changsha's modern development in the late 19th and early 20th centuries is the topic of my dissertation. And there's a chapter in it on this rice riot. And it's also the subject of an article that I recently published.
So for listeners who may not be familiar with the geography of China, place Hunan province for us.
Hunan is located in the south part of China, sort of in the hinterland. So it's a province that during this time hadn't had a lot of contact with the West. It's a agricultural province. A lot of China's rice comes from Hunan, and there's also mining that's very prominent part of the economy there. So yeah, it's a southern province, and it's also, Hunan is famous for its food.
Right.
For its spicy food.
Right. So how big of a city was Changsha at this time? You said it was the capital.
It was the capital city. At this time, it was probably, I would say, 200,000 to 300,000 people.
Okay. So what happened in 1910 with these riots over rice?
Well, basically, to talk about what happened in 1910, I need to go back a little bit to set up the context. But like I said, Hunan was a hinterland province, hadn't had much contact with the West, but it does have a major river that flows north to south. Or south to north, I guess, but up into the Yangtze River. And Western countries, Britain and Japan, who was becoming a colonial power in East Asia in its own right at that time, they wanted access to this river that was coming from Changsha because it flowed up to the Yangtze River to a treaty port city called Hankou. And so in 1902, it was 1902 or 1904, the city opened as a treaty port where Western businesses could officially set up shop in the city. And then, you know, just a few years later, by this time, by 1910, there's more than a dozen Western companies and Japanese companies who've set up shop in a city that was traditionally sort of very anti-Western, had a history going back into the late 19th century of just these anti-Christian riots, these anti-Western riots that had happened when the first missionaries tried to enter the province, and that didn't go well. And the Western buildings were built in this concession area and were built, you know, with a lot of money, and that caused a lot of resentment. And there was an issue with some of the carpenters hired, contracted to build the Western buildings in Changsha were hired from other cities. And this really upset the local kind of labor force of local carpenters. And so that's part of what was happening. And then the other part is that rice was being exported out of Hunan for profit and was controlled by these local gentry merchants. And one of them was this man named Ye Dehui, and he was very wealthy, and he kind of had a bad reputation among some people in the city for just being this greedy rice merchant. And merchants like him would own these large rice houses, these storehouses, because there was a whole system of granaries that existed in the city, some big, some small, but he owned one of the biggest ones. And during this riot, when there was a major shortage of rice, he hoarded grain. And the other thing I should say is there was a big flood that happened in 1909 that caused a lot of peasants from the countryside to flee into the city. And they sort of built a shanty town for themselves outside the south gate of Changsha, because Chinese cities at this time were still surrounded by walls and had gates. And the south wall of Changsha at this time was kind of a gathering area for people who were coming from the countryside, for travelers traveling from the south. And outside the south gate, there was sort of a shanty town along this ridge called the Hungry Stomach Ridge. and a lot of poor people lived there. And there was a pond outside there called Lao Long Pond. And it was there in the early days of April 1910 that a woman took her own life with her two children because she had tried to purchase rice from a local granary owner. She was refused by him because two of her coins that she tried to purchase the rice with were not very good quality. And so she went back and was able to find some better coins. But then when she came back, he told her that the price of rice had gone up just in that short time. And so she was just so desperate. She was this poor woman. And she went and committed suicide in this pond outside the South Gate. And her husband was a water carrier named Huang Guisun, and he found out about it later in the day, and he became so distraught over his wife and children committing suicide that he took his own life as well. So news of this spread throughout the city, and people just became really upset. They were upset at this particular granary owner named Dai Yishun. And then a few days after that, another woman got into an argument with Dai Yishun at his granary over the same thing, over buying rice, because women, you know, at this time were the main procurers of food. And she got into a big argument with him, and a crowd gathered, and it turned into a full-on riot. The crowd turned on Dai Yishun and pillaged his store and beat him to death, almost to death. And then the peasants, I shouldn't say peasants, but the urban commoners who rioted used that as a pretext to eventually march on the government compound in the city. So I kind of summed it up there for you a little bit. Sorry, I went on.
So we've got a very volatile mix going on here. You've got the, as you describe them, indigent lower classes who basically fled to Changsha because their lands have been wiped out in this flood. Rice is at a premium. The rice houses are price gouging people, and they've all converged on the government complexes. Where does the resentment against the foreign enterprises kick in? Or is that just part of the anger against authority?
I mean, there were two kinds of resentment being expressed on part of rioting commoners. One was anger at the local government for allowing these Westerners to come into the city. And this was also at a time when resentment toward the last dynasty of China at the time, the Qing, was kind of at a high. And people were just fed up with the Qing government. And this was the year right before the revolution of 1911, which brought down the Qing, and the first sort of Republican government was established. But the resentment toward the Westerners, I think a lot had to do with just the presence of foreign buildings, the wealth it represented. And then, like I said, a lot of the commoners who rioted were these members of these carpenters' guilds who had been cheated out of work. A lot of the research in this chapter comes from these oral histories that were conducted in the 1970s by this middle school teacher named Liu Duping. And some of the people he interviewed were either eyewitnesses or participants in the rioting.
What kind of foreign business was going on there? Were they exporting rice, and was that part of the resentment?
There were import-export companies. There were oil companies like Jardine Matheson, Butterfield and Swire, two prominent British import-export companies. The Jardine building is one of the most prominent buildings in Hong Kong today.
Right.
So Amco and several Japanese shipping companies. There were also foreign missions. The most prominent foreign mission at the time in Changsha was Yale.
Yale University.
Yale University in 1904 had set up a mission there, but it was sort of a medical mission. They built a school, a hospital, and a medical college that went on to become Yali, named Yali, or the Xiangya Medical School, and sort of established Yale's presence in the city, one that exists to this day.
I want to come back to the oral histories momentarily. So what is the trajectory of the riots? What happens?
The woman committed suicide on April 11th, 1910, and the riots began shortly thereafter and lasted for about 3 days. Most of the oral histories cover the attack on the government compound, during which the governor of Hunan fled, and his lieutenant governor had to take his place. And then by the third day of the riot, things had started to settle down, but a lot of the conspirators, rioters who had attacked the government compound were rounded up and shot and executed. Their heads were placed on the city wall as kind of a warning. But one interesting thing about this riot is that Mao Zedong, you know, who became the future leader of China, was a young middle school student at the time, and he reflected later and years later in an interview with Edgar Snow that, you know, that riot had a big impact on him and kind of shaped his, was the beginning of shaping his kind of revolutionary kind of Marxist understanding of history.
So you mentioned that they converged on the government compound. What happened then?
Well, the Qing government compound in Changsha at that time was sort of a walled city within a walled city. It didn't have much contact with the outside world. And a lot of the officials and runners that were working there were all people from outside of Hunan, because there was a policy in imperial rule that went back. It was called the rule of avoidance. That went back several dynasties, which was basically local officials working in government or politics or whatever would always be appointed from outside the province to avoid, you know, the appearance of favoritism and whatnot. So these were outsiders, and they were perceived as such. So the government compound was a walled compound, and you know, on the outside of it, it had these two ceremonial lions. We call them the Fu lions, that you see in a lot of Chinese buildings today, even like restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
And they toppled those over, and they stormed over, you know, the screen. This is kind of hard to explain, but if you ever enter a traditional Chinese building or residence, a lot of time there will be a screen. There would be a stone wall called the Yuanmen. And it was sort of has to do with these ideas related to feng shui of bad spirits tend to travel in a straight line, and so it would hit this wall and have to divert itself. But anyway, the commoners, they ransacked over that, and then they went inside and they burned the inside of the compound with gasoline, and they also sawed down the Qing government mast, which is like this big giant pole with the imperial banner and the seal of the governor on it, and they took a saw and sawed it down. These commoners were sort of attacking symbols of state power, you know, and trying to delegitimize state power in that way. And what I'm trying to do in my chapter is just sort of give some of these commoners a little bit of agency, because the prevailing theory has been eventually this local gentry, one of them, Ye Dehui, who I mentioned earlier, eventually took control of the riot and took advantage of the crowd's indignation to go ahead and burn all of the foreign buildings and compounds as well. But in historical writing on the riot, there's been kind of a tendency to say, yeah, the gentry took control of the rioters and that's it. But, you know, I mean, it's so hard to gauge, you know, what a crowd thinks or what the crowd does, you know, and every instance in history has its own unique kind of, you know, circumstances. So I don't want to generalize too much, but I just think there's a degree of agency going on in part of the commoners who rioted, because they are disgruntled carpenters. There are people who are starving, and they have a very clear kind of goal in mind to address grievances, you know.
So after they destroyed the government compound, they went to the foreign compound and wreaked havoc there. Was it also similarly destroyed?
There were several foreign buildings that were destroyed. There were schools, like the British consular office, and all these buildings were located on the riverbank, you know, with easy access to the wharves and ports and whatnot. Most of them were destroyed or burned, but the only one that survived, as far as I know, was the Yale compound. And a lot of it had to do with the reputation of benevolence that the doctor in charge was this man named Edward Hume. And they had done enough philanthropic sort of medical work in the city to kind of earn a good reputation. But it's also owing to towns and cities in China in this period were, there was a form of local government or community organization, I should say, there were community associations, neighborhood associations. And this one neighborhood association where the Yale compound was located at the time, right in the center of the city, they posted a notice on the front of the, on the gate of the Yale compound saying, "We are the members of the street association and we don't want this building to be harmed." And it wasn't. And I think that speaks a lot to the power of, you know, of local government and the power of, you know, a community. So again, there's a lot going on. There's a lot informing this riot. It's not just massive people, you know, going on this frenzy. There's some intelligence or consciousness going on. So yeah, the Yale compound was spared. And what's interesting is that this notice was posted, and it was, the actual notice itself was preserved by Yale and is archived at the Yale China Association archives at Yale. And I found it last summer.
Wow.
when I was doing research there, and I didn't, I mean, I had already known about the existence of this this placard, but I had no idea that it would be archived there. And I sort of stumbled upon it. And when I found it, when I took it out of this little crate it was in, I sort of fell out of my chair and was like, wow, because it was in a frame. And what I think probably happened is that it was in a frame, and I'm sure it probably hung in the offices of Yale in China, in Changsha, for many years, maybe even framed by Edward Hume himself.
Wow. You mentioned the existence of oral histories of the riot, and I know from our conversation before we sat down to record that you also discovered these. So how did you find those?
Well, just sort of really randomly, you know. I mean, someone once told me that a lot about doing history or doing the kind of work we do, a lot of times it's just about showing up. And, you know, the fall of 2010, I went to Changsha to do sort of a preliminary kind of research trip, because I hadn't lived in the city at all. I didn't know anything about the city, really. And I just sort of went there to establish some contacts and do sort of some preliminary work. And I was in a coffee shop, and this guy, he was an American, he was an expat who owned the coffee shop. He was kind of a local history enthusiast himself. He'd lived there, he'd married a Chinese woman, and he's like, "Oh yeah, you're interested in local history. You might think this is interesting." And he handed me this book, and it was a book about the Rice Riot, and it was sort of a popular history book, and it was interesting. But what really struck me about it was in the appendix of the book were these oral histories. As a historian, I was like, "Oh wow, wow," you know. And none of these oral histories had ever been used in English language scholarship before. And I found copies of these oral histories in other Chinese language sources. And then I was able to get in touch with the author of the book, this woman named Tang Ying, who's a local writer and member of the Changsha Literary Association. And she's just a very, very sweet woman. And I got to meet with her quite a bit. And she had actually collaborated with the man who actually had done these interviews, Liu Duping, in the 70s. They had collaborated on this book together, and I ended up getting to meet him at his house right toward the end of my field work from 2012 to 2013, and I got to meet him. He's very old. Yeah, so that's sort of how I found the oral histories, and then when you combine those with the other archival work that I did in the city, it lends a lot to the overall project and the overall dissertation.
So which really takes these riots from just sort of a blip on the radar screen to really representing the unique tensions at one moment in time.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Absolutely.
Well, this has been fascinating, and I'm sorry we're out of time, but we'd like to thank you for being with us. This has been another episode. We'll see you next time. You can find a transcript of this episode, along with supplemental documents, suggestions for further reading, and correlations to this Texas and National Educational Standards for History and Geography on our website, blogs.utexas.edu/15-minute-history. That's the numerals 15-minute-history. You can also find a link to suggest topics for upcoming episodes. The University of Texas at Austin is a free speech campus. Opinions and viewpoints expressed in episodes of 15-Minute History do not represent the official position of the University of Texas or of any of its colleges or departments. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.